Call into session the March 5th, 2009 session of the House Subcommittee on Workforce Development. We have two bills here this morning, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on both of them, House Bill 2692 and 2821. These both deal with family leave. And some of you have voiced preference to be able to discuss both of them at the same time. If your comments are attributable to a specific bill, just key us in on that. And with that, we have a witness list.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. It's okay. It appears there may be some of you who are doing double duty this morning in two hearing rooms. Is there anybody who's got time considerations?
I think
so. Okay. What I would like to do is I will call up first Lori Wimmer and Mary Botkin, please. Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm with AFSCME, Council 75. And I'm actually just, I'm going to talk about House Bill 2821 and let Lori talk about 2692, if that's okay with the committee.
That's fine, please.
2821 is the bill that prohibits the employer from requiring individuals to utilize their vacation accruals when they're off on family medical leave. That is a problem for, that has been a problem for us with the state of Oregon. I believe we have it resolved now, but it's been resolved by an agreement, not by law. And, you know, agreements are good as long as the people who are there stay there. But they go away sometimes when the administrations change. And so what we, this would fix a problem for us of forcing our people to use up their accrued vacation time for family leave, whether they want to or not. I mean, they may choose to take unpaid leave for family medical leave and leave their vacation accruals alone. That should be an employee choice, not an employer choice. And so, and I think that really was the original intent of the law when we passed it. And this bill would sort of codify that practice that we have now currently and fix it so that it doesn't happen in the future.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association, and this morning gives me a little walk down memory lane. I've been in this building nearly 20 years, and these bills make me feel old. I've been a part of the conversation around the family leave laws in Oregon from both my current position as government relations consultant for OEA, but also formerly as the director of the Oregon Commission for Women. We played a fairly key role in both the establishment of family leave originally in the 1991 session and then in the improvement of it, working with then Senate President Gordon Smith and Boley Commissioner Jack Roberts and the governor to create an expanded version of family leave law that more smoothly conformed with the new federal family leave law as well, although I would say that Oregon's family leave law was a little bit more forward-thinking, and it was one of those provisions of law that got Oregon some national attention for being on the leading edge of thoughtful ways for not just women, but especially women, to balance career and family and not have to make a choice between building a career and building a family. And so we are here today in support of House Bill 2821 and in opposition, strong opposition, to House Bill 2692. And let me start with the latter bill first. The reason we feel so strongly about the notion that, and this is, by the way, a perennial bloomer, this bill. I've seen it any number of times in any number of sessions since we passed family leave. Gotta give someone credit for perseverance. The whole fundamental notion of job-protected leave is put at risk and turned into a paper tiger when one has to choose between the job they love and have built their career on and caring for a gravely ill family member, spouse, or child, or having a child. Some of the uses, but not all of the uses, of family leave in Oregon. If you are not given job-protected leave, that is, the right to return to your job, that makes the decision matrix much more painful for families or for workers in that particular position. It undermines the very notion of family leave to take away the guarantee that you can return to your job. And that's what this bill proposes to do.
Please, Vice Chair Huffman.
Lori or Mary or both of you, somebody, can you refresh my memory where we are now with the Family Leave Act and what size employer? Because it used to be more than 50 employees or something like that originally. And
Chair Witt and Vice Chair Huffman, we are now at the point where companies with 25 or more employees, or enterprises with 25 or more employees, are subject to Oregon's family leave law. Under FEMLA, the federal law, it's still the 50-employee threshold, and an employee has a choice which law to use. So,
pardon me, a follow-up. Mm-hmm. Is that paid or unpaid, and how? What's the length of time?
Chair Witt and Vice Chair Huffman, it is unpaid leave in Oregon, and the only exception to that, and that's in part how House Bill 2821 comes into the conversation, why we support it, is that when employees have leave, a menu of leaves as a part of their conditions of employment, some of them have paid vacation leave and so on, and when they do, they may use that so that it makes leave more economically feasible to take.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Representative Dembro, did I see your hand?
You didn't. But okay. You saw my mind.
Okay.
Thank you.
We're a close-knit group in this committee.
Man, we need to talk to Barnhart.
Lori, going back to the history of OFMLA, so we were sort of in the vanguard as a state on this issue, and have other states caught up with us in this area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembro, I can't say that this has been a key priority for me in my employment of the last 13 years, given that we represent employees who have these kinds of contract rights built in. So I'm not sure how many states have the kind of law we have. I think it's pretty much an accepted practice. Once FEMLA became the law of the land, most states came into line as well.
Mm-hmm. And if I could just follow up, you know, I know that a lot of employment contracts specify that, you know, one's right to come back to the same job after a leave, many contracts don't specify that, but just, you know, tie the right to OFMLA, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And so changing this would, in effect, be creating a change in their contracts. Is that not true?
Chair Witt, Representative Dembro, yes, that's true.
Okay, thank you. Did you have further testimony?
Only to say that we are very grateful to those who are the sponsors of House Bill 2821 because, as Mary just told you, it clarifies what the intent of the original agreements were, and we feel that that enables the employee to be in the driver's seat choosing how best to negotiate critical time off. And with respect to 2692, the last point I would make in terms of our opposition to that concept is that when we put together the 1995 revision of OFLA, which rolled in, by the way, all the leave laws that we had as a patchwork quilt, in the 80s, including parental leave, pregnancy disability leave, and then the family leave law. There was, of course, a lot of give and take in the compromises one makes in this process, and we feel that those who were advocating for family leave really made some sacrifices in other ways in order to hold on to this critical provision. So it would sort of unravel that long respected agreement.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the committee?
Vice Chair Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori and Mary, looking down through 2692, what is it mainly that you disagree with on this? Because just at first blush here, it looks like it does provide some assurance and guarantees to the employee. What am I missing?
Chair Witt and Representative Huffman, what you are seeing is a scheme that says you may have a job if one is available that is equivalent, but not necessarily your job. So, and with respect to many workers, they aren't just going there, checking in, checking out, going home. They have the pride of building a program. They have the pride of having some expertise, a camaraderie, and so on. And they work in their career. It's not just a job. And so if the guarantee is only that you will receive a paycheck but not be able to return to your job, that is a deal breaker for a lot of folks. Secondly, if you work down the scheme, then it's an equivalent job but not your job. Then it's not if one is available. That's a key piece. If not, though it's silent, the implication is then you don't have the job at all. You don't have a guarantee of any job. And then the 20-mile thing as the third tier. Again, what happens if your job isn't available, an equivalent position isn't available, an equivalent position 20 miles away isn't available, then what? The implication here is that then you have no job guarantee. That's jumping off a cliff and hoping there's a net.
And a follow-up,
please.
And I'm sorry, I didn't write it down if you mentioned it before, and I apologize for asking multiple questions at the same time, but the maximum length of time that we might be looking at, how many weeks is the maximum amount of unpaid leave under OFMLA?
Chair Witt and Vice Chair Huffman, 12 weeks is the ceiling. Most employers have provisions for checking in so that when you're out on leave, you can say when you're coming back if that's knowable, if it's not, you know, if you're not in the hospital unconscious because of your own health condition, which is one of the covered reasons for taking leave, those kinds of things. There are a number of technical details in the law that award a great deal of latitude to the employer so that they can reasonably negotiate how to cover the worker during the period of absence. But the maximum is 12 weeks. And there are also provisions, for instance, if two employers both are working for covered employers such they would both be able to take leave, it's 12 weeks for the family. It's not that each one gets to take 12 concurrent weeks. So there are all kinds of provisions that are meant to be employer-friendly as well in this law.
Question for the smaller employer, say that has 28 employees. Is there any provision that allows the employer to, let's say freak accidents happen and all of a sudden they've got three that are needing to take family leave at the same time, does the employer have to allow all three of them? Or is it first come, first serve, and based on a percentage of total employment, you can allow the first one or two to go, but the third one doesn't? Or how does that work?
Chair Witt and Vice Chair Huffman, there are no provisions that contemplate multiple takers of leave and somehow opting out of your individual employee right because other employee rights collide with yours. That has never been a contemplation of the FEMLA or OFLA or any other family leave law I know of because it is an individually based right. But I know that there have been all kinds of exceptions made in individual workplaces to accommodate that with temporary workers, with leave banks of other workers who offer up their labor or leave or what have you under emergency circumstances. So reasonable people tend to negotiate these things out, but there's really no prescribed way of dealing with those kinds of contingencies, and I haven't heard of that being an issue ever raised when we have the policy conversations of this of these issues.
Thanks for getting me up to speed. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Representative Dembro.
Yes, thank you. And Laura, you just kind of went into a direction that I was going to ask you about it. I would think that in particularly in smallish operations, people are going to tend to sort of work together in finding solutions. I'm just thinking there's nothing in the law that requires somebody to go back to their previous job. I mean, if you know, someone has been hired to replace them and a job, a similar kind of an equivalent job opens up that, you know, they would be fine with, they could move to that voluntarily, right? I mean, something can be worked out. I know in my own workplace I've seen that happen where someone has left for maternity leave and ends up coming back and teaching on another campus, which everyone was quite happy with. You know, there was no problem for either the employee or the employer. That kind of thing can be worked out. No?
Chair Witten, Representative Devereaux, that's true that those things are negotiated, and this is about creating a floor of conduct and rights rather than a ceiling. And there's always flexibility or contract language that can exceed or go a different direction. So long as there's that fundamental basis of your guaranteed job, you can, as a worker, elect, for example, to go to a part-time status or what have you. Another thing that happens, though, under the scheme of the 20 miles is that sometimes when the caregiving need, new baby, adopted child, terminally ill spouse, that kind of thing, it occurs, having to, if they were required to commute that 40 miles round trip every day, that would add a significant burden to their ability to balance work and family. And I recall back to my days at the commission, we saw lots of studies about worker productivity enhancement as a result of having these leave laws in place that really improved the environment of the workplace in terms of attendance, productivity, morale, all of those kinds of things, because families felt that they were able to do that balance successfully.
Additional questions or comments? Lori, the 20-mile figure, is that in a statute? Is that a federal act, or are we using that as a hypothetical example?
Chair Witt, no, I was referring to House Bill 2692, which would prescribe a scheme in which,
okay. All right.
In which
thank
that
you.
Would be the third
I,
tier.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if
yes,
I can, I hesitate to remind all of you that one of your own colleagues is married to one of my colleagues, and she is currently on parental leave with the birth of their first child. And, you know, we work for a relatively small employer, and the rest of us pick up the workload. I mean, that's what you do. Because, as Representative Dembro indicated, you know, you sort of work in a team, understanding that covering for Janice O'Malley Galizio today means that she gets to cover for one of us later when it's our, you know, when it's us that's on leave. But, you know, the reality is that you make do, and you make, you know, everybody else pulls a little more weight to make sure that that individual's job is still in place when they're ready to return. And it's something that you just do for the workforce because it's the right thing to do. And it means that the other three members of the team work a little harder, but and it means that Joe Basler gets to do child care, which I think is making him a much more sensitive individual.
Very good.
I would
agree.
You know, covering child care is a good experience for Joe. I don't know where he is.
Mr. Chair, I heard that you were being sent out of state when Janice comes back.
You know, I have seniority and and, you know, I will cover for her so that she can return to her job. But if there's any out-of-state duty, I won't be the one doing it. Thank you very much.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification, your question about the 20-mile figure being in statute. It appears it is currently an Oregon statute in the bill on line 13. I don't know if it's in the federal statute.
Yes, Kevin just pointed that out. Yeah, thank you to me. Yes, he did. Thank
my
you.
My apologies.
Anything further? I certainly appreciate your testimony here this morning. And, Lori, I don't know if you're going to be able to stay here during the remainder of the hearing, but recognizing your expertise and your history in this arena, if there are particular questions that the committee has, you might be valuable here. If you could just kind of stand by, I would be
happy
most
to.
Appreciative. Thank you both very much. Folks, normally when we have pros and cons here, I kind of like to go yes, no, and I now have a matrix because I have two bills, and some of you are yes, and some of you are no, and so I'm just going to kind of toss that out the window and ask that you just have that understanding. And I recognize that Mike Sullivan has a time constraint, so Mike, why don't you come up, and if you had somebody else that was going to appear with you, that would be fine too.
Good morning, Chair Witt and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, commonly known as AWPPW. I'm here representing AWPPW and their support of House Bill 2821. Talking with Vice President Greg Pallison of AWPPW, he has told me that collective bargaining protects the employer from making employees take vacation with family leave, but there have been ongoing problems. The intent of the law was the family leave was a benefit that cannot replace another benefit, and vacation is a benefit. I will say one example of the problems that have happened to a local of AWPPW, Local 878. Before the current contract language, the human resources director then would go so far as to make the employees take 6 weeks vacation to take care of a sick family member. The current contract language offers some improvement, but the employer is still applying family leave when they think it's a qualifying event without any further process. This is a big issue for the employees who are trying to dodge this family leave bullet, if you will. Some employees have chosen to take sick days to save their vacation for when they choose to use it, not when the employer thinks that they should. In closing, Chair Witt and committee members, AWPPW is in full support of 2821. The belief is that this bill will close the loop on the intent of the law. I will now try to answer any questions you may have of me.
Thank you very much, Mike. I certainly appreciate your appearance here today. Committee members, anything for him? Not seeing or hearing anything, Mike. Thanks very much. I certainly appreciate your
thanks. And I appreciate this committee, but I don't know if I should call you the Brady Bunch or not. You're so tight.
Thank you.
Brainy or Brady?
He said Brainy. I'm sure he did. All right. With that, I'd like to call up, please, J.L. Wilson.
Right. Thank you. I don't want to be sent.
Thank you, Chair Witt and members. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the employers of Associated Oregon Industries. And I'm going to talk broadly about both bills, not any one specifically. Obviously, 2692 was at our recommendation. And I think the message from our employers right now, I'd ask you to go down either one of two tracks. One track being, can we just hold pat for a couple of years, even if that means not moving my bill or any bill? Could we just stand still for a couple of years? Or on the flip side, can we put together sort of an omnibus bill or a comprehensive package that we address the concerns of family medical leave? Maybe something like 2821 is put in the bill along with some of the concerns that employers have. See, I'm not married to the language of 2692. What employers, this bill was last introduced in 1999. That's the language we took. But it addresses a need for employers to have some measure of flexibility on what to do with employees when they come back from 12 weeks of family medical leave. The concerns that Ms. Wimmer brought up are, many of them are legitimate, and we do not intend to undermine that process, merely get to the issue of allowing some measure of flexibility. Our employers today, the ones that do business in multiple states, tell me that Oregon is and I have no way of verifying this other than what, it will need further research. But Oregon is just one of those few states that you don't have that measure of flexibility. 2692 was at the request of a specific member who is undergoing litigation now because of someone who was working a graveyard shift, took the 12 weeks of family medical leave. It was just a better fit overall when they came back to put this person on a swing shift. That was done. The employee liked it. It was thank you, thank you. Then after a couple weeks, it was a no-show, no-call. For a week at a time, the employee was terminated, and all of a sudden the lawyer was slapped with a lawsuit that they did not put their employee back in the original position. So just so you understand, that is the sort of thing that I'm trying to preclude. The other issue that employers are really wrestling with now is the issue of ease of access into the family medical leave system. How it is, and just by way of, just so you have some base level of knowledge, I mean, a manufacturer in the state of Oregon with a couple of hundred employees that work, put together a product or in food process, you're looking at administration costs of family leave of $500,000 or more a year. This is a significant issue for Oregon companies. I don't want to leave you with the impression that this is without cost to employers. But you have a system today that allows intermittent leave for certain medical conditions. Often this is in the form of migraine headaches, something along those lines. You will literally, we have employers, and I'm happy to have them talk to you, where you have employees that were a calendar year will take 6, 8, 10 weeks of leave, all in single-day increments that, by the way, always happen to occur on a Monday or Friday. That kind of ease into the system is another issue that is really critical for employers, something that we'd like to see addressed. The overall picture, why my preference is to ask that we hold pat, though, for a couple of years. Just to harken back to 2007, the last legislative session, the changes that were made in family medical leave, 2460, House Bill 2460, divorced time off for workers' comp claims from family medical leave. It used to be on a disabling injury, the FMLA clock ran if you took time off work. It counted against your 12 weeks. 2460 passed and created that wall of separation. You could have your workers' comp leave and then subsequently take the 12 weeks of family medical leave. 2485 required an employer to pay an employee accrued sick leave for family leave, even if the worker might not have been eligible for that pay under employer policy. So another policy that was enacted that was favorable to employees. And then, of course, 2635, which expanded family leave to include illnesses of grandchildren and grandparents. So three very significant changes. And I have to tell you, at every employer conference for the past 18 months, whether done by the big law firms or employer groups, these issues were brought up every single time, because these are not small changes. They are significant changes. So that's just to illustrate, there has been a lot done by this body in terms of family medical leave. Now, add on top of this, the sheet that I passed out to you. New Department of Labor federal regs of family medical leave. Now, pages and pages and pages of new regs, but this is a 15-page document, and what this 15-page document tells you are just those regs in which federal leave and state leave don't match up, that an employer has to decipher which one to follow. 15 pages Here, and my thanks to Boley, because Boley put this document together for employers to analyze. But you've got 15 pages of new regs implemented by the federal government in which there is conflict with Oregon Family Leave Act. And the right-hand column is the analysis of Boley as to which of the two leaves an Oregon employer is supposed to follow. I'm trying to convey to you this is a nightmare. And if we could leave things pat for a couple of years, that would be my preference. Because right now, in addition to dealing with the laws that were passed by the 2007 Legislative Assembly, we've got 15 pages of regs that were just dropped in the last month, in which we now have to go through the process of deciphering, do we follow Oregon law, federal law, why? This is an education process that takes some time. So I leave this with you to ponder, to look at. Like I mentioned before, Oregon Family Leave covers Oregon employers down to 25 employees. It is different from the federal regulation, which requires employers of 50 or more. Our preference, obviously, is to stand pat. As it relates to House Bill 2821, you know, this is an issue that will drive employers nuts in the context of all else that is going on, because 2821 is, again, another separation from federal law. Federal law clearly allows the practice that 2821 wants to separate from. And so that's just yet another issue that employers will have to deal with that is separate from federal law. So I leave this with you. Again, I am happy to take part in a discussion that is comprehensive. I would enjoy that opportunity, and whether 2821 is part of that package, that's fine. We come to this discussion with an open mind. But I really wanted to set with you the true context of all these family leave bills that are taking place, because we are dealing with what was passed 2 years ago by this body and with a whole dump truck full of regs that were just put on us by the feds that we now have to navigate as it relates to whether it's federal, whether it's state, what we have to follow. So it's a lot, and would appreciate your consideration of that.
Thank you very much, JL. I'm sensitive to the amount of tracking that has to be done in terms of whether it's state or federal law that applies. As your chart shows, it's considerable. So I think that's something that we all need to be cognizant of. Representative Esquivel, and then yes. I think Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, did the same person do this that did the tax codes between the two?
I'm not tracking it.
Well, they're all different. State and federal can never seem to get on the same page.
Yes.
And it seems like we always end up in a silo, each one of us, whether it be state or whether it be federal, but we're all in a different silo, and we do not understand what each state does in comparison to the federal government. And the federal government, I'm not sure what they do.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. JL, what does Oregon law, let's just deal with Oregon right now, on family leave, what's the definition of that? You gave an example of an employee taking off, you know, 8 weeks or so per year on Mondays and Fridays because of wanting a three-day weekend or a hangover or whatever that reason might be. I mean, from my past experience employing people, that typically is what it boils down to, those two things. But what did that individual in that instance that you were conveying, were those days off taken under the family medical leave?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Witt and Vice Chair Huffman. These are not isolated incidences. I'm not making it seem like it's widespread, but I think what you'll find is in you know, any large facility, there will be folks who know how to do this, who take intermittent leave at various points in time that might be adjacent to a weekend or a holiday or something like that. It's commonplace. I'm not saying it's widespread. Everybody does it. No, just like everything else, it's 1 to 2%. But when you look in terms of overtime that's paid, temp employees that are brought in, and overall administration, I mean, those costs build up. That leave was in fact taken under OFLA, and I'm happy to put HR people in front. They're people that don't exactly want to be on the stand to talk about this, but are happy to talk to you privately about what happens in their workspace and how the law is used.
What is the scope or the definition of family medical leave and what truly can be taken? It sounds like, with your example, it's pretty broad in how you can take a day or a week or whatever off.
Well, this particular leave was intermittent leave. That's all I can. Obviously, ease of entry into it. I think we'd like a few more safeguards in place, which is why I just raised the issue. If we want to have a more comprehensive discussion and a little more give and take, but you know, the issue is significant.
Kevin, do we have the statute for Oregon family leave so that I could check and get more up to speed on what the parameters mm-hmm. and definition of
that a copy of it for you.
Statute actually is?
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, some of the circumstances, JL, that you mentioned, I think, you know, clearly would be defined under a sick leave or something like that. And hopefully there are provisions for employers to prevent abuse like that. I'm not saying there are. I would just hope that there would be the latitude for employers to be able to deal with mm-hmm. abuses like that.
Yeah.
Like you say, they are somewhat isolated, 1 or 2%, but it tends to be those bad apples that tend to give everything, you know, the bad flavor. And I'm speaking for myself as an employer. I had a key employee that, and I only, I think at the time, had 11 full-time employees, not counting myself, and they were headed home and ended up going into grand mal seizures, and I mean, his life was upside down for 12 weeks. And he did a technical job that I was the only one that could step in. So for 12 weeks, I was doing my job and his, because, you know, in a small organization like that, it's like Mary said, you're family, and you just roll up your sleeves and you get in and cover for somebody. And I did. And, man, it was difficult, very difficult. And I know that, you know, 11 employees, 25, 50, 200 employees, as you increase employees, the dynamics are different. The dynamics are totally different in an organization from 25 employees to 200. So
that's absolutely. I would I'd like to have Kevin give us a clarification. Then I'm going to have Representative Holvey's questions, followed by Representative Esquivel.
A couple things, and I'm going to look to the crowd, and if I get the big shake-off from each of you, essentially there's the overlying is there are federal and obviously state statutes dealing with federal or dealing with family leave. Within the context of each of those sets of statutes, there are specific definitions of what constitutes eligible employees, employers that are covered by each of these respective. Within Oregon, it's codified, the family leave aspect is codified in ORS 659A, 150 to 659A 186, I think approximately in the ORS, this is where it's located at. That sets forth, again, some generalized definitions of who would be covered under the Oregon Family Leave Act, as well as the eligible employees exclusions, and so it's kind of a mush through the terminology. But these are definitionally driven statutes, and so you have to meet certain thresholds to be covered or not. And what I can do is provide the committee members copies of those specific sections, the 150 to 186. And if there's something else in particular, again, those in the crowd, please feel free to contact me, and I can add those particular statutes into the packet for the members. But that's kind of the 50,000, not even our 35,000, but a kind of 50,000 foot view. And if an employee or rather employer qualifies and the employee qualifies, then there is a right to family medical leave. Different states do have different qualifications. I believe California, I'm not even going to go there, but each kind of has their own different programs as far as what you can take. I believe that there are certain states that do have a component of paid family leave in certain instances. The parameters of that are far beyond what I could describe at this point. It would take an extensive period of time to actually go into. But that's kind of, again, 50,000-foot view. And I'll follow up with the people who have spoken about getting a packet of information for each of you to take a look at.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate that. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. JL, thanks for your testimony. I am sympathetic to any abuses that take place under the Family Leave Act. I know that's not the intent of our any of our legislation, is to allow, you know, abuse of the system, and it would be interesting in trying to corral that. But specifically to House Bill 2821, in your testimony, you described that this bill, if passed, would take away something that's allowed under the federal a practice that's allowed under federal family leave, if I heard you correctly. But at the same time, if House Bill 2821 was passed, it wouldn't be in conflict, or would not, with federal family leave. From my understanding of the bill, we would still be in compliance with federal law. It's just that we would we'd be a little bit more restrictive in allowing the interpretation that's practiced under federal. If I'm correct, is that?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, thank you, Chair Witt, Representative Hull. I don't want to make it sound like we're in conflict with federal law at all. What I'm suggesting is federal law allows the practice of an employer making an employee use vacation time while on leave. That's all I'm saying. Federal law allows that practice. 2821 proposes to divorce ourselves from that practice, and in that instance, Oregon employers would clearly follow Oregon law. Yeah,
right.
That's all I intended to say. What I want to say to you is, there are so many instances that Oregon employers are going to have to decipher between Oregon deviations from federal law now, that this is just another one that will cost employers more. I'm not even saying if we could work this in the context of a package that's balanced to employers and in something like 821, I'd be happy as could be to engage in that discussion, put something like that together. But my preference, obviously, as I alluded to before, is to hold pat for a couple of years and let all this settle.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess my point is we have several places where the Oregon OFLA has a different take than the federal legislation. But notwithstanding that, they're not necessarily in conflict. They just have slightly different standards in certain situations.
Right, Chair Witt and Representative Holvey, and that is illustrated very clearly down this right-hand column. When you have these differences between state and federal law, at least the labor commissioner's recommendation of where an Oregon employer might follow, and you'll see the most common comment is that OFLA or FMLA employers follow the OFLA regulation, which is more beneficial to the employee's circumstances. That is the most common refrain you'll see down that column.
Yeah. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I would just note that, you know, Oregon laws are oftentimes have differences than federal law, and it's not unusual in this particular industry or section of law as many other sections of law that we have. You know, our state statutes do differ from federal law without, you know, being in conflict with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that clarification. Additional questions or comments for JL?
I have a few for myself here. I know you mentioned the swing shift instance where the employee came back, and it had the appearance at the time that there was a general agreement between the employee and management that swing shift might have been a good thing at that time. I guess the way things currently exist, that under the law, in order for the employer to have
protected the company's interest, that the employee would have had to have been brought back to the original job and then bid on the swing shift if he or she wanted that, in order for the employer's protection. Would that be accurate? In other words, the company brought an employee back. Swing shift seemed to be a better fit rather than, I guess it was the day shift?
Graveyard.
Okay, so the swing was preferable, but then the excuse was used that the employee was not brought back to his or her regular shift. And in order to have prevented that that legal liability from occurring, then the employee would have had to have been brought back to the graveyard and then bid into the swing. Yes? No?
I don't know enough about the,
okay,
the specifics.
Okay.
That very well could be.
But it seems, at least when there's a general agreement, that is an awkward situation for both parties. Representative Esquivel, did you have questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think that the other thing we have to keep in mind here, not all companies bid jobs.
Uh-huh.
Some of them do not.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I think it's easier to, and I've managed 100 and some people at any given time, and it's personally easier to do to manage a union shop than it is a non-union shop, because you just read the contract and you go by the contract, and it's very simplistic. Is it there or is it not? But we are dealing with some very small companies. You're talking under, you know, over 25. And that, to me, if you have 26 people on the payroll, that's a pretty small company, actually. But, you know, we have to keep in mind here that we have a very, very different and diversified workforce and management of each company itself. Is that correct to state that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. One of the issues that we have is before us with the bill is the word similar work instead of the same job. And I know that you had mentioned workers' comp several times, and we had a similar problem in workers' compensation that was resolved several years ago with respect to light duty, and at that point it was a group of injured workers that had requested consideration by the employer community that similar work was not working because it provided the employer an opportunity to send someone to a Goodwill, to farm them out to Goodwill, to send them 20 miles or even greater than that to work, and those issues were resolved, I think, to the satisfaction of both the employer and the injured worker community. I am not as close to workers' comp as I once was, but I think it's working for everyone still, and I'm wondering if there's an opportunity here to have something that works better for management and doesn't disadvantage workers in this instance.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Witt. We both drifted away from the comp arena, thankfully. And I remember working on Senate Bill 485 and that component back in 2001. It's interesting the sort of the machinations this issue went through in 1999, where you could see it through the original bill, then the A engrossed, then the B engrossed, the new safeguards that were added to ensure there were, to ensure that there was equivalent or pay, equivalent responsibilities, location, that there were tight parameters drawn around those things so as not to try to strike that balance between flexibility for an employer and ensuring the same level of employment for the employee returning back to work. And that legislative history is there in the 1999 session. I forget what the bill number was. I think it was like 2486. But it's clear to see the path they went through to address that very issue. And we can, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. We can just look back and see the amendments that were added to draw some parameters around that.
Thank you very much. Anything further? Jill, appreciate your appearance today. Thank you. I'd like to call up, please, Tricia Smith and Rob Wagner. And Graham Traynor, if you want to come up, too, with them.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I'm happy to be here with you so early this morning. I am here to put OSEA's opposition to House Bill 2692 and support for House Bill 2821 on the record. Ms. Wimmer was talking to you about her personal experience in OFLA, and indeed she was a driving force for a very long time in bringing forward the rights of employees to have both their job and their family in the same life. I can recall when I chaired the Labor Committee in the Senate. Did you realize there used to be a Labor Committee? The subject of OFLA regulations being more restrictive than federal regulations was one that was discussed quite often in my office. And folks would come in and tell me that it was just too confusing. Just let us go back to the federal regulations because we can't run on two sets of regulations. I was not swayed by that argument because the Oregon regulations are on top of, not conflicting with, federal regulations. So if you follow Oregon law, you're going to be pretty safe under federal law. It's not that difficult. I recall the first session after the language was put in OFLA that required employers to return employees to their equivalent work. That first session afterward, this issue came up again in a very large discussion in this building. And much of the testimony was kind of similar to what you heard, describing an employee's abuse of the system and an employer being caught up in a lawsuit as a result. I think you know that you can't pass a law that will prevent people from suing an employer. There's just no way. The Constitution prevents you from passing that law. And sometimes people are going to do things that they should not do, and then they're going to try to do other things that they should not do. For example, abusing leave laws with the Monday morning sick, and then suing you if you fire them for it. Nothing in this bill will prevent any sort that kind of abuse from occurring. It will. It's going to, and I'm sorry that it happens. I wish all people were perfect, don't you? But they're not. This law doesn't need to change. It was put in place because of employers' abuses of their employees that required people to come back to a job that was not their own job. In the case of classified school employees, I was thinking about how this would work for classified school employees. Classified school employee is an instructional assistant, let's say, teaching a special ed kid that she's been with for 3 or 4 years. She goes out on maternity leave and she comes back, and her employer tells her that her job is filled, she can't have her job back, but there is an equivalent custodial position in a school 20 miles away. It's equivalent because it pays the same. Under this bill, under 2692, I would argue that that employee would not have any legs to object to that change. That's what we're talking about here. This language was put in very deliberately to deal with employer abuses that prevented people from taking family leave when they had a family emergency that required them to be at home and still protected their jobs. So 2692 is unnecessary. Employers have lots and lots of tools under family medical leave to assure that employees are actually legitimately on leave and to assure that they come back when they need to come back. As for 2821, one other point about 2692, our labor contracts do not address the change in 2692 because the law did. So we didn't have to put something in our contract to protect us because the law protected us. all of those contracts, all of those people would be vulnerable to this if this law changed. And we'd have to spend a lot of time negotiating with our employers to restore that right to our employees. As for 2821, we've had situations with employers in the past requiring that our members use their vacation before they are able to go out on unpaid leave. The difficulty with that is as individual as individuals are. For some people, that's perfectly fine. But for other people, their vacation time is first of all, it's compensation. They've already earned it. And it would be like requiring them, you're already giving them unpaid leave, but then to require them to pay for their leave with their vacation is, that should be an optional situation for an employee. When I went out on family medical leave for my own disability, I used my vacation because I couldn't afford to go out on unpaid leave. And many people do for that reason. But it should be up to the employee. That vacation time is compensation they've already earned, and the employer should not be allowed to decide how they spend it. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Tricia. I think I'm going to have the panel complete your testimony, and then we'll ask you questions all at once.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Rob Wagner. I'm the Political and Legislative Affairs Director for the American Federation of Teachers here in Oregon, representing education employees from pre-K through post-secondary, as well as healthcare employees. I think a lot of my comments have actually been preempted throughout the last hour, both in terms of questions from you, of Ms. Wimmer, as well as just in previous testimony, so I won't go at length. I will say that I don't have the institutional knowledge of a couple of my colleagues, and at risk of having spitwads shot at the back of my head from Ms. Wimmer, 20 years ago I was actually in high school when I was on this issue, the chair of the Senate Labor Committee. But I did have a conversation with one of our former local presidents about this, and I think that we do share some of the similar concerns around contract protections for our membership. In terms of the comments that were made previous by Mr. Wilson as well, I think there are broader social and legal implications around when you start talking about federal-state tensions. The Oregon Family Medical Leave Act was revolutionary in its time, and again, I lack some of the institutional knowledge, but it was one of those things that I think people really do look toward Oregon as being an innovator, public beaches and the bottle bill. And if the federal law wanted to preempt states from being able to pass stricter standards on family leave, then they certainly have the capacity to do that. But I think by allowing a permissive structure where we can strengthen our law to address the needs of our working families, it actually benefits Oregon and the working families here. So my final comment would be just to say that standing pat or standing still in terms of leave laws this session, we're actually part of I don't want to open an entire can of worms here, but we're part of a coalition, and I was very proud of this body last legislative session in passing House Bill 2575, looking at actually family leave insurance, and hopefully this session we will be making some progress on that. So I know there'll probably be some red faces and more spitwad shot at the back of my head, but that will be something that we're interested in having a discussion. I don't know if it'll be coming through this committee, but further on in this legislative session as well. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Graham Traynor, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO. And just before I get started, I want to mention that I am on point on this issue because our political director, Duke Shepard, is actually on family leave due to the birth of his first child, and the Oregon AFL-CIO has far fewer than 25 employees. I just wanted to make a few comments. Again, as Rob had mentioned, a lot of the things that I meant to say have been preempted, but I did want to mention one thing regarding Mr. Wilson's testimony about the current, the January federal regulations that went into effect for FEMLA. Current state law forces any employer who is required to abide by both the federal and the state laws, so that's an employer of 50 or more, to enforce the one that is more favorable to the employee. That's something that's on the books today. The packet that Mr. Wilson handed out, you know, talks about a lot of the conflicts and Bully's analysis. Bully just last week actually has conducted three public hearings on the issue, hearing from the public about their concerns with these new regulations and whether or not the state should streamline both laws through the federal law and these new regulations. Again, going back to the point that any employer who's required to abide by both laws is required to abide by the one that's more favorable to the employee. If you look at this packet, you know, the majority of all these conflicts, OFLA is stronger. So regardless of whether these you know, regulations went into effect or not, again, these employers who are bound by both are required to follow the one that's stronger for the employee. So I just wanted to make that note. And again, for the record, you know, the Oregon AFL-CIO represents over 225,000 working families in Oregon and was a big part of the original family leave law and the fight that happened over a decade ago, definitely before my time. So I'm not going to speak with the institutional knowledge that folks that have preceded me have, but it is something that Oregon has been proud of for over a decade. Oregon, or Rob mentioned, you know, the pride that Oregon feels for being an innovator in many ways. And you know, Oregon's family leave laws, as we all know, you know, were on the books prior to the federal laws, and is definitely stronger. And I just want to call House Bill 2692 for what it is. It's chipping away. It's something that you know, Oregon has been proud of. It's something that's chipping away. It's something that Oregon has worked very hard at, and it's something that's not necessary. And the Oregon Family Leave Act has worked well for over a decade. So again, the Oregon AFL-CIO is on the record in opposition to House Bill 2692, and I'm just going to echo everything that's been said prior to me. House Bill 2821 is something that we are in support of. You know, this decision of whether or not to use accrued vacation time during family leave should be the choice of the employee, not the employer. So thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions as well.
Thank you all very much. Questions for any one of them? Representative Polby?
Nope.
Oh, that was just a stretch there.
It's okay. Kind of a sigh.
Anyone else? Panel members, thank you very, very much. Is there anyone from the public who didn't have an opportunity to sign up but would like to testify on either of these bills at this point? I'm not seeing or hearing from anyone. I will tell you that I am going to allow the record to stay open on 2692. If there are folks that want to come forward and suggest a way of dealing with this bill, I'm open to that. I know that the suggestion has been made that perhaps we deal with a comprehensive reform, and I am not prepared to go there. And I also want to underscore that offer was made in good faith, and I respect that very much. But I don't have that many years left in my life, I don't think. So with respect to House Bill 2821, the chair is hopeful that we can move that bill here sometime in the future. Additional questions or comments on either of these bills from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Besquick.
You know, in this, what I call this little silo we have here in the Capitol, it would really be interesting to have an employer come in that had 25 to 30 people and talk about this. I mean, I'd really like that sometime.
We could perhaps do that, Representative Esquivel. Maybe that.
And the reason I say this is, Mr. Chair, is that I worked for a company one time that had 300 and some employees. But the problem is we had 16 different operations, and we were under 20 usually in every operation. And, boy, it's tough to juggle people.
I understand that very, very well.
Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on both House Bills 2692 and 2821. Kevin, if you would please tell us what we have on tap here in the near future.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, coming attractions. Next week we're going to be looking at, we're in the midst of finalizing the amendments with respect to 2732, which is the task force. I'm hoping to have those back any day, and I think the goal is possibly to move that to Ways and Means, which is the next step, getting the fiscal and whatnot put into place. We're also going to have a presentation next Tuesday in conjunction with 2732, dealing with the career colleges who will be speaking with respect to that. In more of the unspecified dates, we are currently in the midst of, as you all know, 2398 and 2399 we've been involved in. There was a work group, not this last week, but the week before. We are in the midst right now of trying to see if there are situations or programs in which compromises can be reached to move something. I think it's a priority of this committee to find something to move forward. We're in the midst of putting that together, and hopefully we'll have some amendments to legislative council in the near future. I hesitate to put a date on it just at this point because I'm not sure when those amendments will be available. However, there are some discussions about places where compromise can be reached to move something forward on workforce development. So,
and just for the committee members' information, those amendments are being drafted around the matrix that was developed following the hearings on those bills, which were passed out to the committee members. And everyone will have an opportunity to review those amendments before we work either or both of the bills.
Yes. Okay. And that is absolutely true. That's kind of the framework with which negotiations, I understand, are going on is kind of zeroing in on those particular elements in the matrix and seeing if we can get some language that we can get to LC and move forward. We don't have specific dates on when that's going to be available, but it's going to be coming here in the near future. So.
Okay, and I know that we were waiting for some fiscals, I think, on some of our work. Yes, no?
Yes, we do have. We're waiting. We do have 2821. Okay. We do have the fiscal and revenues with respect to that. 2692, if the committee so chooses. We do not have the fiscal at this time. With respect to 2732, which is coming up, we need to get, per the new policy with respect from the Speaker's office, before we can obviously move bills, we need to have the fiscal and revenue for both the bill and the underlying or whatever amendments are on the table as well. And to my surprise, that's coming even in the case of a gut and stuff in which you're removing all the language. I thought we would be saving fiscal some work on not having to do basically a fiscal on a dead bill because you're gutting and stuffing it, but apparently we need to have a fiscal and revenue for that as well. So,
and just to for my memory, if no one else, that change in that bill deals with which issue?
2732.
Yes.
We are adding additional individuals to the task force,
okay,
as well as modifying the language instead of just giving general recommendations urging Representative Esquivel, instead of just generalized report that there are recommendations that come forward from that task force, so there's something to move in the direction of.
Very good. Thank you. Committee members.
Chair, can I just ask a question?
Please.
It is 2732, is the sense that that's going to be treated as a standalone subject, or is that going to be wrapped into the matrix that we're talking about? Because those two seem pretty related, don't they?
Good point, Representative Dembrough. They are very much related, but at this point, it's my inclination to treat them as two separate bills. Now you know what we know,
that's reassuring.
We don't know what we don't know.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the order? With that,
and one other follow-up, just with respect to our discussion today, I'm assuming I've given you the statute. Giving you the statutes, would you like? Would the members of the committee like me to circulate those general provisions just so you have them on file, like a digestible paper?
That would be great.
All right, I'll go ahead and do that. And if there's something else from want to throw in there, please see me. Get them to me. So,
all right. Seeing and hearing nothing further, this committee stands adjourned. Thank you all.